current state here on 90.5 WKAR. You made it to Friday. We all made it to Friday. Yay, us. We wrap up today's program, and then virtually all the rest of our day today will be spent finalizing our two-hour program tomorrow at the East Lansing Art Festival. Current state will be in front of the East Lansing City Hall on Abbott Road from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., visiting with artists and musicians and organizers. We hope you can stop by and say hi or smile as you walk by, as they say. Later on this hour, tonight's an interesting night. Tonight is the first night of Lansing United. This is the new soccer team. Jeremy Sampson, late of Channel 10, is behind Lansing United, and he spoke with our Scott Pohl about launching this soccer team. He's an intense soccer guy, and we will talk with Jeremy, and we'll learn about historic preservation here in Michigan from Nancy Feingood of the Michigan Historic Preservation Network here. But speaking of the art festival, it returns for its 51st run this weekend. It's a two-day event in the city's downtown core featuring more than 180 artists and musicians. And for many longtime attendees, the East Lansing Art Festival signals the unofficial start of summer. Here to tell us more is current state's Kevin Lavery. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Mark. Yes, it will be very interesting this year to see just how large the crowds are at the East Lansing Art Festival. It's a huge social event for the community, and I think all of us here in mid-Michigan are still sort of shaking off the cabin fever that we got over the harsh winter. I spoke with Festival Director Michelle Carlson about this year's event. This is her first year as director, and she tells me that the last-minute logistics are running pretty smoothly.
Everything's going really well. We're just getting all our supplies together in one location and getting our signage ready, and we're trying to mark the booth locations for the artists off on the street is where we're at right now.
And do we know how many vendors and artists we have, the size of the festival this year?
We have about 183 artists coming. It may vary a little. Sometimes we always get a couple people at the last moment that cannot come for whatever reason. So we have seven of those are emerging artists, so they're first-time art festival artists, so that's exciting. We have nine food vendors in the food court, and we have several organizations in the children's activity area that will be offering hands-on arts activities for kids of all ages.
How does that size stack up to festivals past?
It's a good size comparable to the last couple years. Several years ago, it was much bigger, over 200 artists, but we found having under 200 is more pleasurable for artists and patrons as well, because it's not so cramped. Everyone's not cramped in, so there's a little more breathing room.
You've got a brochure here in your hand, Michelle. Is it possible to mentally walk me through the festival grounds? What types of attractions can I expect to see over the course of the weekend?
Well, we have, as I said, 183 artists spread out throughout the streets of the center of downtown East Lansing. On the one end is the food court, which is by Ann Street Plaza. And then next to that is the children's activities area. And then if you continue on and go north up Abbott, you'll run into our music stage. And at the music stage, you will find various acts throughout the day of free live music.
Are there any major changes or additions this year?
New this year is a selfie scavenger hunt for teens. So any teen between 13 and 18 can come to the information booth and get a list of activities to look for throughout the festival.
I'm trying to picture in my mind what a selfie scavenger hunt looks like. Obviously, there are photographs involved.
Yes, so we're encouraging kids, or teens, I should say, to pick up the list. So, for example, it could be City Hall. I don't know if that's one of the activities. But then they would take their picture, which is a selfie, in front of City Hall, and there will be 10 different things that will bring them throughout the festival.
What types of art genres are we seeing at this festival? Certainly there is much more than just your traditional canvas oil paintings.
Yes, there's lots of painters, but we also have ceramics, lots of photography this year, interesting jewelry, some drawings and sculptures, metal work, fabrics, both fiber wearable and non-wearable items, some leather things. So a wide array of things to interest everyone.
Based on what you've seen in past years, Michelle, do festival goers tend to gravitate toward one particular style of art? Is there one that's really, or maybe a couple, that are more popular than the others? Or does that change over time?
I think we have such a wide variety of art that it appeals to a lot of different people. So I think you can find something for everyone, no matter what your taste is in arts. And I think the interesting thing, what people enjoy about the festival, is that you get to meet the artist who made the piece of art. And that's a really unique experience, that you can talk to the artist about what they're doing, how, what their process is, how did they come to this piece of artwork. I think that gives value to the art. It gives you a personal connection to things that you like if you learn the background story of it. And I think that's one of the main attractions of the festival.
You know, even before Memorial Day, I think a lot of people in mid-Michigan tend to view the East Lansing Art Festival really as the beginning of summer. What feelings do you hear from people in this community? Maybe they've come to the festival for many years, you know, maybe some are new. What do they tell you about what this means to them as an annual activity?
Many people just look forward to it so much because, especially this year, they've had a long winter indoors. And it is the first big event where people can get out, see friends or neighbors they haven't seen all winter. So that's something people look forward to. And it's a really large event. So many people are out. And people, now we have a lot of volunteers coming that said, well, I came here as a child with my parents and I just love it so much and now I want to volunteer. So it really is a strong tradition in our community.
And what does it really do for the region, both economically, certainly it's a boost, but also culturally in terms of putting East Lansing on the art world map?
I think, well, the festival is ranked in the country number 56 this year out of, there's approximately 4,000, give or take, fine arts festivals in the country. So we have a very good reputation with artists. They enjoy coming to East Lansing because our patrons are very knowledgeable in the arts and purchase their art, so they enjoy that a lot. So bringing great art to the area, we're in the middle of Michigan, it's accessible to people, not in the Lansing, East Lansing area, but beyond. It's an easy place to get to. And being a juried festival, which means it's very competitive to get in to the festival, it raises the caliber of art that we do have exhibiting here, which gives the festival a lot more value. Attracts more people, and the more people we have in our downtown helps give businesses exposure and extra business during the weekend, and attracting people from outside our, you know, Ingham County region. You know, it's just like a showcase of what we have to offer, and people from outlying areas might not know what a gem we have here in East Lansing.
What are some logistics this year, Michelle, that people should be aware of when they're planning their trip to the East Lansing Art Festival? Last year, there was horrendous construction right outside the front door on Grand River Avenue.
As far as I know, there's no major construction projects near the festival grounds, so you should have easy access. The festival roads in the center of downtown will be closed. All of the parking ramps will be open and available. You can also ride your bike to the festival. We have free valet parking for people who ride their bikes. Or there's a lot on Hagedorn and Service Road on campus where you can park for free and take a CATA shuttle bus into town for 50 cents. So you have a lot of options. It's a rain or shine event, so even if there's some sprinkles, just get your umbrella out and come downtown and see some great music and some wonderful art, run into your neighbor, or meet some new friends.
Michelle Carlson is the coordinator of the East Lansing Art Festival, which is celebrating its 51st year in 2014. Michelle, thank you for having time for us.
Thank you very much for having us.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
Sounds of Wissal there and their Balkan Middle Eastern fusion, and they will be at the East Lansing Art Festival. In fact, Current State planning to speak with members of Wissal. They'll also perform for us live tomorrow as we spend a couple of hours, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the East Lansing Art Festival. Stop by in front of East Lansing City Hall on Abbott Road. We would love to see you. It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. For many months, Michigan legislators have battled over education. Often it's been over the Common Core, new curriculum standards that Michigan and more than 40 other states will adopt soon. The ongoing dispute has taken a number of turns in the past week or so. For one, the Republican majority legislature made millions in school funding contingent on continuing the Michigan Education Assessment Program, or MEEP, tests for K-12 students. The Michigan Department of Education had been planning for several years to drop it and move to the web-friendly, smarter balanced assessment. Then on Wednesday, fed-up GOP Representative Bob Janetsky filed a measure that would transfer oversight of student assessments in Michigan from the State Department of Education to the Treasury Department. He and other Republicans say they've been frustrated by claims from the Education Department that there isn't time to revise the MEEP test for next school year. To get his take on these and other developments, we turn to the chairman of the Senate Education Committee, Republican Phil Pavlo. Senator, welcome back to Current State.
Hey, it's good to be with you this morning, Mark.
Before I ask you what you make of Representative Janetsky's proposal, clarify for us where you stand regarding the Smarter Balanced Assessment and the MEEP test.
Well, listening to your opening comments, it's very clear the legislature is very interested in this topic. And the legislature gets interested when parents and teachers reach out to us with their concerns. And what we're hearing from the people in the field that are going to be required to administer this test, the parents whose children are going to be tested under this curriculum, they have concerns. And so all we're asking for is a fair and open, honest conversation about what assessments should look like in Michigan. And there has been a back and forth with the department in terms of, should the legislature weigh in on this? And, I represent 275,000 people in the thumb, and they have concerns. So I think it's fair that we just ask the right questions and get the answers to something that a testing system that could be around for 20 years or longer. We just want to get it right, and that's where the legislature is on this issue.
Describe for us in a little more detail, if you could, the concerns that you're hearing about. What concerns these families and these parents?
Well, let's start with the teachers because, we've asked for a lot of accountability from our teachers, and we'll gather that accountability partly through some of the testing that our students are going to be required to take. And so if we don't have a very solid and dependable, reliable test, then we're going to be actually asking our teachers to be accountable to something that could potentially have some challenges and some complications to it. We're also going to be asking our students under this smarter, balanced assessment that the department has chosen to take an expanded amount of time in testing, and we know how students react to stressful conditions. The testing periods seem to be at least twice as long in some cases. And are we really putting all of the focus on testing at the cost of instruction? And these are just questions that come up. You hear parents all the time, my son or daughter is so stressed out coming into this new testing period. So all we want to do is get something that works that the teachers can accept, the parents can accept, the students can accept, but at the bottom line, we need to know if the local curriculums are working, and that's why the test is so important, why we're having the conversation.
Representative Tom McMillan, who is a vocal critic of the move to the Smarter Balanced Assessment, says he's tired of what he calls the can't-do attitude from the Department of Education on this. Yet Superintendent Mike Flanagan has compared relaunching the MEEP to making a pig fly. Do you think the Department of Education could realistically relaunch the MEEP test?
I don't think there's any question in my mind that they can. and that the legislature is going to require that they do. And here's why, Mark. You're looking at states across the country that are fleeing from the Common Core. They are so intent on getting their own state control of their public education system. South Carolina just last week, they decided to pull out of their testing system, and they're required to have a new one up by the spring of 2015. This is something that I think can be done. And I'm very happy to work with Superintendent Flanagan and his team over there at the department to get the resolution we need to it. It's an important next step in our state's education system. So let's get it right.
Let's clarify. Let's back up just a little bit and clarify one key point regarding the Common Core curriculum. These are indeed standards that were arrived at nationally. But doesn't the Common Core allow for local control of the actual curriculum?
It does. So sometimes we confuse terms, and when you call the Common Core curriculum, it's the Common Core state standards.
Very good.
So
yes, you're correct. Exactly right.
Yeah, so the standards are like a yardstick. It's a measurement. And this is what, you know, you should be expected to know in math and in language and in science and so that's the yardstick. I think one of the important things, we have 552 local school districts in Michigan, and they're the deciding factor on the curriculum. And so you bring up a very good point. You know, parents are becoming more and more engaged at the local level, and that's really where education should be delivered. So we want to drive them to our school board meetings and have a better understanding of what their children are being taught. And I think the more people know, the more transparency, I think the better system that you get. So we're just interested in more involvement. And yes, you're right, it's a standard, not a curriculum. But let's hold the accountability factor in place, too, so that we get it right. We can't decide from the state level a top-down education policy. What we can do, though, is make sure that we have an assessment tool in place that can accurately, effectively, and in a time-sensitive manner help us understand what our kids are learning and what they might need help on so we can make adjustments to improve their outcomes. And this is all about the children's and the students' outcomes in our education system.
Representative Janeski says he thinks the legislature's been stonewalled by the Department of Education. That was his word. When he has tried to get information on test options, has that been your experience? I mean, would you describe it in those terms as far as your experience?
I probably wouldn't use stonewall, but I would say that the free flow of information to the legislature has been less than stellar. Look, this requires trust. It requires relationships, and it requires some input. And I think what I hope the department figures out through these exercises we're working on right now is that when our constituents, I just had office hours this morning at Lakeport Grill up in Lakeport, Michigan, people come here, they come here to see their local elected officials and they want to address their questions and concerns about government to us. There's no one calling the State Department of Education to a bureaucrat somewhere on the seventh floor of a building somewhere. They're talking to us. I think it's good government when your legislators are out in public hearing what's happening and being able to take that conversation to Lansing and have a respectful dialogue. And this is just the flow of information. This is what's on people's minds right now.
We're talking with Republican State Senator Phil Pavlo of St. Clair County. Phil is the chairman of the Senate Education Committee, and we're talking about all of the various developments here regarding education in Michigan at the state capitol here the last few weeks. Let's look a little bit more closely at Representative Janetsky's proposal. He and others are wondering aloud if they're getting a different set of answers from the if they would be getting different answers from the Treasury Department than they're getting from the Department of Education. We'll point out that the Treasury is overseen by the administration, and the Department of Education and the state superintendent are overseen by the State Board of Education. Do you think state assessments would be better managed by the Treasury Department?
I think it would be, and I co-sponsored the Senate version of that bill. Senator Caswell from the Hillsdale area in Michigan introduced the very same language yesterday, and I co-sponsored and I support that. I think that timely information and the decision process could be improved, and I think that you would get that from an oversight out of the governor's office. And, so we'll have hearings on it. We might have a hearing as early as next week where we'll get input on it. But I think the reality is that education is the cornerstone for Michigan's economy, for Michigan's quality of life. And if we're struggling for sometimes years at a time on some of these issues, I don't think it serves the students well. They're wrapping up their school year this year. They're thinking about their summer breaks, yet the adults in the system seem to be kind of locked in this battle of control. It shouldn't be a battle of control. It should be a battle of information in a timely way that can be reacted to, that has transparency, that can be communicated back to our districts. And I think by pausing the implementation of a very big system, it just makes sense. In your earlier comments, you talked about a web-based, technology-driven system. I am a strong advocate for technology in our education system, but what we have seen by some of these, some of the computer systems that have been piloted, we're seeing problems in the execution. So the legislature is right to voice their concerns, as it relates to new technology, too. So.
The education, to get back to the MEEP and smarter balance debate, though, the education department's apparently been planning for years to drop the MEEP test. Can you help our listeners understand this particular disconnect between the legislature and the Department of Education? How did this disconnect unfold?
Well, you saw transitions in education policy when we're driving for more accountability and higher standards and testing. And so the Common Core state standards have been being developed in Michigan since 2010. They've been implemented in our classrooms. We now are to the point where we have to start measuring the outcomes of the Common Core state standards. And I think what happened is that the department just has been going down this path of, they chose a smarter balance system. It's been developed. It still isn't done today. There hasn't even been peer review yet on this test. But what's happening in a parallel track is that other testing options and methods and models are coming onto the market as well. And so we now have a marketplace for testing. And we don't want to get, kind of committed into one unless we know. In the end of the day, if through the RFP process and the evaluation of all of the test systems out there, Smarter Balance proves to shine head and shoulders above any other assessment out there, I'm fine with that. We're asking for is let's take a little bit of time, keep what we have, adjust it to the new standards, and use this period of time in a constructive way to look at what other options are out there. And in the end, if the department, and it's proven out that the Smarter Balance is what's best for Michigan kids, I'm there with them.
Where exactly, Senator Pavlo, is the discussion on the expansion of the Education Achievement Authority right now? And what's your position on the EAA expansion?
Well, I've been a supporter of the EAA since Governor Snyder introduced this idea because, the unfortunate reality is we have some very poor performing schools in our state that need an additional level of support. And so, out of over 4,000 school buildings, we rank them from top to bottom in the state, and we're required to do something different for the schools that are in the bottom 5%. And just think about it for a minute. If you're dropping your son or daughter or granddaughter off to a school that is one of those very worst schools in the state of Michigan, what kind of future do you think that those kids have in a system that, in a school building that had been failing their students for sometimes a complete generation? And so it's difficult dealing with the poor performing schools, and it's hard to turn them around. But we have an obligation to make an effort, and that's what the EAA has been all about. That's been the center of the mission, and it's been to deliver a different kind of education to kids that absolutely deserve something better than what they were getting a few years ago.
Help me understand one thing, though, Senator. I mean, you've said that the teacher evaluations and the standardized tests, you know, we need to know that those are working and that you want to get to something that works. But regarding the EAA, what have you seen during the EAA's last couple of years that gives you confidence that we know it works well enough to expand it statewide? Why not wait for more data there as well?
Right. Well, it's already statewide, Mark. It's for all schools in the bottom 5%. It just happens to be that it was launched in the DPS system. So this is taken into consideration schools all across the state. And when we talk about schools that aren't making the grade, we're not just talking about urban schools. There are rural and suburban schools also that have challenges for any number of reasons.
But why the urgency on moving on some set of reforms and on the EAA reforms and the delays on the other? Can you help us understand that?
Well, I mean, the idea of a teacher assessment tool has been relatively new. This is a conversation that's just been taking place in the last 2 or 3 years.
But and isn't again, the EAA relatively new as well?
Oh, the EAA is absolutely new. And what you can point back to is, number one, that the schools that are in the EAA have a very long proven track record of failing students. What we can point to now after a year and a half of, or coming up to our second full year, is we're starting to see some encouraging growth model, some growth measurements that we're starting to see students get more than a year worth of growth in a year worth of instruction. But remember, we're talking about moving into a school building where there hasn't been a history of good, solid, strong education. So
yeah, there's a lot of problems there too.
Sure,
clearly.
Sure, and that's why this is such a difficult assignment. It's a little bit easier to manage a very well funded and high performing school. Those are a different set of circumstances. What we're talking about is, you know, school buildings that have been failing students for any number of reasons, and going in and turning it around. And I think it's proven to be, we knew going in it was going to be a difficult assignment, but that doesn't mean we don't do it.
Phil Pavlo is the Republican senator from St. Clair County. He serves as chairman of the Senate Education Committee. Lots to keep our eyes on. Thanks for your help understanding this, Senator Pavlo.
Well, it's good to chat with you this morning, and enjoyable weekend to you and your listeners.
It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. Interest in soccer will soar this year when the World Cup is played in Brazil. With that in mind, if you were going to start a new minor league soccer franchise, a World Cup year would seem to be a good time to do it. And tonight, Lansing United will play their first National Premier Soccer League game, and Current State Scott Pohl is here with more. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Mark. Jeremy Sampson is a former local sportscaster who no longer works in TV sports, but he still has a passion for sports, especially soccer. That passion led him to explore the idea of owning a team. I talked with Jeremy Sampson this week about his lifelong appreciation for the game and the skill it takes to play soccer.
I did play as a youth. Unfortunately, my high schools that I went to didn't offer it as a sport. but there's something about the game that, and it's a little bit like hockey, that I can't do it. You know, I can hit a golf ball, I can hit a baseball, but there's something about the game at its highest level, and the level that you'll see here in Lansing with the NPSL, that I can't do myself. And I have a great respect for that. And I think that's what really draws me to the game. And part of it, Scott, to be frank, is that it's a little bit of the black sheep when it comes to sports. And I'm okay with that. I'm not necessarily a front runner all the time. And supporting something that's different appealed to me at the same time.
Well, a World Cup year would seem to be a great time to start a new soccer team. Is that part of your thinking here?
There's no question. There's always a spike if you look in the interest in the game of soccer during a World Cup year. We looked at maybe launching this venture in 2013 and thought, you know what, let's hold off. Let's get the most out of this that we can as far as interest is concerned. So there's no question that there, 2014 was the reason that we launched it this year was because of the World Cup.
Describe the league that Lansing United is going to play in. How's the level of play? Is it better, say, than what you might expect to see if you went to a Michigan State men's soccer game?
I think it's very similar. It will be very similar to that. The NPSL is the fastest growing soccer league in America. We've added over 30 teams for the 2014 season and want to continue to expand. What these teams are a lot of the best players from the colleges around the country who get together to hone their skills and get themselves ready to go for their seasons in the fall. So you're seeing the best of the best. NCAA rules say we can only have 5 from any one school, so it can't be an all-star team from Michigan State per se, but it will. You'll see the best of the best from the colleges around the Midwest.
I want to know more about how that works, because I assume you can't pay collegiate players. Do you have some paid players on this roster? How does that work?
The league stipulates, and a lot of this is done through the NCAA as well, that you can only have a team full of entirely professionals, which some teams in our league do have, or entirely amateurs. And you're right, if you have an individual who's playing college soccer, they can't receive payment because the NCAA would deem them ineligible at that point for receiving payment for playing. So our team is listed as amateurs, if you will, from a USA Soccer and NCAA perspective, so that they do not get paid. We do have some individuals who have played professionally elsewhere, but their status with us through USA Soccer is that of an amateur.
Now, you held some open tryouts. Did anybody from those tryouts make the squad?
They did, and we announced our roster earlier this week, our pool of players, if you will, at 45. And if I remember correctly, it was 6 or 7 from that tryout who stuck on the final 45. So we were pleased to see almost 90 people come out for that tryout. And our head coach and general manager, Eric Rudland, saw a lot of talent from those players who did come out, and we were happy that we were able to keep a couple from it.
What's the age range?
We are mostly, and somebody asked me that the other day, the average age I would guess would be 22-ish. We do have, again, the majority of our players are college age, so you're talking 19 to 21 or 22. We do have a couple of older players that'll push that up a little bit, but that's the age range you're looking at.
We're talking with Jeremy Sampson, the owner of Lansing United, the new soccer team in Lansing. How did you choose the name?
The name, well, the whole process, Scott, I stole from the Lansing Lugnuts. Back when they first had their name or formed their franchise, they did a name the team contest. And it started some buzz in the community and also added some ownership from the community that they would have a part of naming this franchise, and I wanted to do the same thing. And so we had a contest that we ran, and people submitted names. We had over 500 submissions for team names. And when it came down to it, I looked at the word United. And for me, I wanted to find or make this entity a way to unite the soccer community in mid-Michigan. If you know anything about the youth structure, there are some factions within it, and I wanted to try and find something that would bring all those entities together to kind of pull for one common goal. So we had actually 9 different entries of people who picked Lansing United, and they'll be honored Friday night before our first game for picking the correct team name, if you will, but that's how we went through the process.
And the team colors?
The team colors were done at the same way. We took suggestions for that. But I partnered with a local marketing and branding firm in Lansing called Traction. Cam Ganas and his staff helped us with our logo, our colors, and building that brand. So they took the information that came from the name, the team, and the colors that people suggested, along with what I wanted the club to stand for, and we put it all together. And that's how we came up with the red, white, and blue, and our blue being a little bit more Carolina blue, or light blue, if you will.
Where are you going to play your games?
Our home games will be played, 7 of the 8 will be played at the East Lansing Soccer Complex. Our last regular season home game for the conference will be played at DeMartin Stadium at Michigan State. That's when we play the team from Detroit. They're called Detroit City. Their average attendance is a little over 2,000. And I know they'll be bringing a good number of people with them. The East Lansing Soccer Complex holds about 800 in the bleachers, and then there's room for standing room. So with them bringing the number that they're going to bring, put with our fans, would just, you know, we would be busting at the seams at the East Lansing Soccer Complex. So, you know, my thanks to Mark Hollis, Greg Iani, and the folks at Michigan State who have helped us be able to play that last game at DeMartin Stadium.
The team has had some preseason games known as friendlies in soccer. How did they go?
We won the first one 4-0 against the Ann Arbor Football Club, and stepped up in competition a little bit, played the Michigan Bucks on the road. They're considered the same level, fourth division, if you will, in USA Soccer that we are. Played a very competitive game, and then we played on Tuesday during the monsoon, if you remember, and we only got about 20 or 30 minutes into that game, so that one got postponed.
Aside from wins and losses, how are you going to gauge your success?
It's a great question. Success for me, when I started this club, I wanted to look at growing the game of soccer in mid-Michigan. Will I be able to gauge that after year number one or our season mid-May through mid-July? No, I won't be able to. But if I can share a quick story, during our tryouts, there were some youth teams that were playing. And one young boy was walking after his game back to their vehicle, and he walked by our table and he saw our sign and some of our apparel that we had, and he said, Dad, when I grow up, I want to play for Lansing United and I want to be famous. And it made my day. I mean, that's what this is all about, really. It's all about having positive role models for our young soccer players in our community. They've had role models in maybe some other sports, but haven't had those role models to look up to. And I won't be able to gauge that in the first 3 months, but hopefully, you know, 1, 2, 5 years down the road, we'll be able to see that, hey, we've made an impact in growing the game.
There's a fan support group on Facebook called the Sons of Ransom. I want to ask you if that's officially sanctioned, first of all, and also what's the story behind that name?
It is officially sanctioned. They are the official supporters group of Lansing United. Very passionate soccer fans. We wanted to find a name that was soccer relevant and also tied in some of the history of the city of Lansing. R.E. Olds was the founder of Oldsmobile. Of course, everybody knows that they were the big industry in mid-Michigan for many, many years, stopped producing automobiles about, 10 years ago now. But the R in R.E. Olds stands for Ransom. That was his first name. And so we put all that together, and that's how we came up with the Sons of Ransom.
And you have a Latin motto.
We do. I butcher it every time I try and pronounce it. My Latin is terrible, but I'll try. Coniunctus Verbis stands for with connected strength. And again, that comes from that united and wanting. Our kind of motto for our team was pride, passion, and unity. And bringing everybody together, again, with connected strength. Our team is going to play with connected strength on the field. Our staff is going to work with connected strength to give the fans the best experience that they can have.
All right, what are the details about opening night on Friday night?
There are so many of them, but let's go through them bit by bit if we can. Kickoff is at 7 p.m. Our gates will open up at 6 p.m., an hour before kickoff. Tickets are $5 for adults, $3 for children 12 years of age and younger. But we are doing a special event this first game. We're calling our youth soccer extravaganza. So any youth player in mid-Michigan wearing their community jersey, their club jersey or their high school jersey will get in for free. We want to show them the level of competition and introduce them to this high level of soccer that, that they might have a chance to see this summer. And we're also going to do a giveaway, a home jersey-like t-shirt. So it's a replica of our home jersey to the first 400 fans who come to Friday night's game. They will get that, and that's compliments of Castle, Capital Area Soccer League. They're the umbrella over all the youth organizations in mid-Michigan.
Jeremy Sampson is bringing soccer to Lansing with Lansing United. Thank you and good luck.
Thanks, Scott. I certainly appreciate it.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State. Historic preservation stakeholders from across the state are meeting in Jackson this week for the annual Michigan Historic Preservation Network Conference. The network works to recognize and conserve Michigan's architectural culture. The organization is currently working on projects around the state, including several here in the Lansing area. Here to tell us more is Nancy Feingood, Executive Director of the Michigan Historic Preservation Network. Hi, Nancy.
Good morning, Mark.
What are some of the bigger challenges that face the historical preservation community?
I would say they are the lack of incentives to do historic preservation. In 2011, Governor Snyder eliminated tax credits, and since then, we have a hard time incentivizing folks to do proper rehabilitation.
Did the elimination of those tax credits have a noticeable impact on your work?
They have, primarily in residential local historic districts. There's actually been historic districts around the state that have investigated eliminating their local historic districts because they no longer have what they believe to be an incentive to protect those properties.
Mm. Are there fewer people trained in restoration in 2014 than in the past?
I think as far as, actually doing the restoration work, the craftsmen and the artisans, I think there is definitely a lack of people available, and that's actually what we do. We train people in those skills so that they are available to do that kind of work.
And you are involved in a number of projects across the state that allow that kind of training opportunity. I know a big local project that you're involved in is the restoration of the Knapps Building in downtown Lansing. What's been your role in that restoration process?
Actually, we work with them on the financial incentives. They received one of the last of the state tax credits, and we partnered with them as a nonprofit so that we could help sort of expand the value of those benefits.
That's less a hands-on project than it is a financial project, then, is that
That's
it?
That's correct.
Okay. Where does the Knapps Building project stand right now?
It looks beautiful. Both the facade work is almost done, and they're working pretty hard on the interior. I would say it would be their deadline is fall. They have tenants. They actually have an incubator, a design incubator that's going to be one of their tenants, and both for graphic designers, jewelry, clothing, and then they'll actually have a retail shop that sell their products as well. It's very exciting.
But that's a fall opening for the building?
That's what they're looking for.
Okay,
things don't always go as we planned.
That's the goal. Okay.
Yes.
Just last month, your organization ran a window restoration job training effort in Vermontville in Eaton County. What structure got restored out there?
It was originally a church, and now it's used pretty much as a community center. And we trained 10 unemployed or underemployed contractors, and sometimes it's people that just, you know, want to change careers to do window rehabilitation, and they restored 8 of the wood windows. There's many more to be restored, but now there are actually people in the community that can do that work. And when they're done, many of these people actually go out and start their own businesses in window rehabilitation. There's a huge need across the state for those kind of skilled people.
How do these windows need rehabilitating exactly?
Many of them, you know, have not been maintained. Most of them have not been maintained for many, many years, and people think the resolution to that is to take them out and, you know, insert vinyl windows, replace them with vinyl windows. But, you know, the wood has deteriorated. The pulleys or the ropes have been broken, so people think, you know, they can no longer open them, though they just need to be replaced and repaired. Many people think that they're drafty, yet, you know, all they need to do is take them out and put in some appropriate insulation. So many of those windows have been there for 100 years and certainly, you know, served the purpose and will be there for another 100 years if they're maintained.
But the old glass, I mean, is the old glass often is it as good as keeping the cold out and the cool in as newer glass would be?
It is, and of course it's much more beautiful. But we also encourage and we train our participants to build storm windows, either interior or exterior storm windows, and that actually functions much better than like double pane vinyl windows.
We're talking with Nancy Feingood here on Current State. Nancy's the executive director of the Michigan Historic Preservation Network. They're holding their annual conference right now in Jackson. We're talking about historic preservation work around the state. What value does historical preservation add to placemaking? I would think a lot is there's a lot of potential there.
Absolutely. In fact, we say, you know, historic preservation is the original placemaking before there even was the term placemaking. And one of the things that we've been able to survey and determine is that, for example, commercial buildings or houses that are in local historic districts, you know, draw young people. Young people want to be in communities where they feel a sense of place that's walkable, that's historic, that where the architecture, I call it, it's street art, where they can look up and acknowledge and appreciate what's around them in the street. It also, I mean, properties that are within local historic districts maintain their value far better because your neighbor can't, put on a six-story addition. They're limited, and so your own home appreciates and maintains its value better.
Mm-hmm. Another project recently announced here in Lansing is the renovation of the Abigail Building, which was part of the former School for the Blind here in Lansing. I guess the plan is to convert the building into affordable housing. Tell us about the Abigail Building.
Well, the School for the Blind, the campuses, the buildings are beautiful, and the campus is not designated as a local historic district, so they can be a little bit more lenient with the changes that they make. But that property and those buildings have been laying, you know, fallow for a very, very long time, and I'm really excited about the fact that they will be rehabbed or restored and used. you know, we're not of the belief that everything needs to be done exactly as perhaps Secretary of Interior standards require. They can't always be done in that fashion, but we appreciate the fact that, you know, that developers, like with the Abigail, are willing to at least, you know, make the right decisions in their rehabilitation.
Nancy Feingood is the executive director of the Michigan Historic Preservation Network. Nancy, thanks for joining us and good luck.
Thank you so much, Mark. That was fun. Have a great day.
Just a quick reminder that tomorrow, Current State makes a return visit for 2 hours to the East Lansing Art Festival. We'll be right in front of East Lansing City Hall on Abbott Road from 11 to 1. We hope you can stop by. Lots of guests, live music, and more. Stop by and say hi tomorrow in downtown East Lansing. Coming up next week on Current State, May is morel season. We'll learn about cooking with the highly coveted mushroom. Also live music from Lindsay Liu and Josh Rilko. That and more next week on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks to Emmanuel Berry, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery. Also to Aaron Young for engineering. I'm Mark Bayshore. Have a great weekend. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.